Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 723, Doing the Earth Island Boogie. This program is being recorded on August 29th of the year 2010. This program is both interrogatory in nature and also quite complex. We're taking a look at developments vis-a-vis the Earth Island, that vast stretch of land running from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, the Middle East, what was the former Soviet Union, China, India, Pakistan. It has most of the world's landmass, most of the world's population, most of the world's mineral resources, especially petroleum and natural gas. And across the middle of it is a stretch of Muslim population. And power politicians and geopoliticians have long sought either to ally or control that Muslim population as a vehicle for achieving world domination. And we've been looking at a number of developments vis-a-vis the Earth Island. In Side 1, we took a look at an apparent rapprochement between the Obama State Department and the Russian government, in particular with regard to the Islamists in Chechnya. And just about exactly that same time, the Russian spy scandal broke in the United States. And also, we've been taking a look at some of the ethnic unrest in Kyrgyzstan, tension between ethnic Uzbeks and ethnic Kyrgyz, and possible attempts by the Hizb-ut-Tahrir, a Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated organization, to exploit that unrest in order to gain hegemony and sway in that particular part of Central Asia. And obviously, one of the questions that I've been asking is, to what extent are the jihadist elements that were supported by elements of U.S. Intelligence and really the Republican/underground Reich faction of U.S. Intelligence and State Department at the December 2009 jihadist conference in Georgia. That's Georgia in the former Soviet Republic, not Georgia, U.S., one wonders to what extent that jihadist conference may be connected to the unrest in Central Asia. And in turn, I wonder to what extent the rapprochement between Obama's State Department and Russia vis-a-vis Chechnya may have led to the surfacing, the very weird surfacing of that Russian spy scandal at almost exactly the same time as the two countries were working towards a diplomatic rapprochement. Something else I want to point out is that Russia has had a tremendously hot summer. And in turn, there have been a number of very devastating wildfires in Russia, peat fires and other forms of fires, which have not only devastated the Russian wheat crop, driving up the price of wheat, but have also caused a tremendous amount of social dislocation and economic damage in Russia. And one of the things that I want to recall for people, I'll put some of this in the description, but simply due to the limitations of time, we're not going to have time to go into it here. But in For the Record 667, we took a look at jihadist elements, specifically seeking to use wildfires and forest fires as weapons in jihad. So obviously one of the questions I'm asking, and I don't pretend to have an answer to it, is I wonder to what extent some of those fires in Russia may have been deliberately set by jihadist elements. And also here in this country, we have a technology called Project HAARP, which the stated patent applications involve controlling the weather. It's a pretty safe bet that other countries at this point have similar technology. To what extent might a Project HAARP/Tesla technological application have something to do with the drought in Russia? I don't know if there's anything to that. But again, the U.S. and former Soviet Union had a treaty on environmental modification for purposes of weaponry and military campaigns that was on the books in the mid-70s. So I would not dismiss the possibility that such a technology and Project HAARP, its stated applications are to control the weather. I would not entirely dismiss the possibility that there may be some modification of the weather involved there. Is there a combination of HAARP and forest fire jihadism? I don't know, but I do think it's a question that needs to be asked. Just as I'm seeing a sort of indications of a binary policy, binary foreign policy vis-a-vis Russia with regard to Chechnya, with regard to Central Asia, so too, just as Russia has given permission for the U.S. to transit across Russian territory to support the war in Afghanistan, and just as recently Russia has begun assisting with the training of Afghan police and security forces. So, too, there appears to be an element that is active in Afghanistan that is actively working against Russia. So once again, I'm wondering to what extent some of the jihadist elements that are working against Russia and perhaps looking to gain control of some of the former Soviet Central Asian states and their fossil fuel resources, to what extent are some of those same elements responsible for the following? They're obviously in Afghanistan, one of the central crops that the Afghan population has to support themselves is the opium crop. One of the things that a lot of people, one of the things that has been suggested is that perhaps agricultural diversification could help the Afghan farming population to move away from opium poppies. But the fact of the matter is that farming opium is a major way for the average Afghan to subsist. And as a result, there has been a huge, of course, opium harvest in Afghanistan, which for quite some time has been the world's leading opium producer. The following, once again from New Europe, NATO rejects Russia's demand to destroy Afghan poppy fields. This is from March 26th. It reads in part, NATO and Russia clashed on March 24th over how to tackle the drug problem in Afghanistan, where Western nations have been fighting a Taliban-led insurgency for 8 years. The country is the world's largest producer of poppy seeds, a key ingredient in the manufacture of heroin. Russia is keen to pursue an aggressive eradication strategy, while Western allies fear that such an approach risks antagonizing the local population who rely on selling poppy crops to survive, Deutsche Presse Agentur reported. The Russ skipping down. Afghan opiates led to the death of 1 million people by overdose in the last 10 years, and that is United Nations data. Is that not a threat to world peace and security? And this is a Russian official named Viktor Ivanov, and he was the head of Russia's Federal Drug Control Agency. And so again, a lot of Afghan heroin has been finding its way into Russia, where it's producing a lot of damage in Russia. And NATO has rejected the Russian demand to destroy the Afghan poppies. Now again, without some sort of substitute, destroying the Afghan poppy harvest could actually lead to increased support for the Taliban and similar Islamist elements. On the other hand, with abundant evidence that some of that Afghan heroin is being flown into the United States, courtesy of some elements of U.S. and Western intelligence allied with the traffickers, it is interesting to contemplate Russia asking the U.S. to destroy, or asking NATO to destroy the Afghan poppy harvest, and NATO refuses, and we also see the following. This is from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website. Russia, U.S. aiding Afghan drug trade. This is from April 5th. Russia has accused the United States of conniving with Afghan drug producers by not destroying opium crops as U.S. troops advance in Helmand Province, one of the major opium-growing regions. The allegation, which came in a statement from the Russian Foreign Ministry, was the second time this week that Moscow has criticized the West over the opium issue. NATO rejected the charge and said Russia could help by providing more troops to combat the insurgency. So again, I'm wondering whether the signs on the one hand with Russia permitting transit over its territory for troops and equipment to fight the Afghan war, Russia also collaborating with NATO forces to a certain extent with regard to training Afghan security forces. At the same time, one is wondering whether perhaps Safari Club slash Islamist slash Muslim Brotherhood slash Underground Reich elements, and with their associated components of U.S. intelligence, are still seeking to use the Afghan opium harvest as a vehicle for once again doing damage to Russia and for doing damage in some of the former Soviet Central Asian states. Again, I'm wondering whether this contradictory binary foreign policy that appears to be manifesting itself also applies to the Afghan opium harvest. Now, again, I want to stress that this is speculative in nature. There's an awful lot that has not been grasped vis-a-vis the flotilla incident, but we're going to add, although that will be discussed at greater length, there's already a post about that in the news and supplemental section, much of which I'm going to reread for the purposes of this broadcast. One of the most interesting aspects of the flotilla incident, and that is how it impacts Turkish politics, and in particular the Turkish political outlook on other Muslim peoples of the Earth Island, and in particular, the implications of the flotilla incident for Islamist activity, not only in the Middle East, but also in the former Soviet Central Asian republics and Russia itself, but also the implications of pan-Turkism. I think need to be weighed in connection with the flotilla incident. One of the things that's so interesting about the flotilla incident, well, there are a lot of things that are interesting about it, but we're seeing the same sort of grotesque rhetorical distortions that we're seeing vis-a-vis the 911 mosque, where just about everybody seems to be getting this wrong in one way or another, just as there was a spectacular failure on the part of Israeli intelligence to grasp who they were dealing with. I remember talking to people, friends of mine, and said when I heard that this flotilla was headed for Gaza, and saying, well, here comes the next incident, and we're going to see the usual suspects saying the usual things after whatever sort of outcome this particular incident has. And sure enough, it turned into the next incident. What Israeli intelligence was thinking is, well, that is known to perhaps Israeli intelligence alone. It's beyond me. I saw this thing coming, and it's amazing to me that Israel could not. Certainly, they failed to grasp fundamentally, as have the defenders of the flotilla, the nature of the people in that flotilla. Those were not a bunch of peace activists, although there may have been some peace activists involved. Rather, the IHH organization had previously been cited as a terrorist organization by the very Turkish government, which appears to have had much, not the very Turkish government, but by the Turkish government, a later version of the Turkish government, now associated with Islamists, in fact appears to have had much to do with the IHH and the launching of that flotilla. For starters, one of the people who investigated the IHH group was a guy named Evan Coleman, and from Counterterrorism Blog we find the following. Shooting the Messenger, this from June 1st of 2010, Shooting the Messenger, a look at the facts on the Turkish aid group IHH. When I first published a research paper 4 years ago with the Danish Institute for International Studies, or DHS, on the Turkish Muslim charitable group Insani Yardım Vakfı, or IHH, I didn't imagine it would get much of a response outside the academic conference in which it was presented in Copenhagen. However, as a result of this weekend's tragic Israeli raid on an IHH-sponsored flotilla of vessels attempting to break the ongoing blockade on Gaza, the group has suddenly jumped into the headlines and has become a focus of intense debate over the intentions of the flotilla organizers and the controversial killing of at least 9 would-be participants by Israeli commandos. Though my DHS paper made no mention of IHH's activities in Gaza or in support of suffering Palestinian refugees, some of those angered by the Israeli flotilla raid have instead turned their emotional animus on past critics of IHH, such as myself. While I certainly can't speak with any authority on what took place on the Gaza flotilla boats, I'm rather mystified why the flotilla killings, whether right or wrong, would have any bearing on the factual question of whether the IHH has engaged in illicit financing and episodic support to extremist groups. The evidence in this regard is fairly weighty, and much of it comes directly from the Turkish government, not the United States, nor the Israelis. On December 5, 1997, Turkish police raided the IHH headquarters office in Istanbul and arrested its principal leaders. Following their preliminary inquiry on April 27, 1998, Turkish investigators launched a formal legal case against the IHH. According to a report produced by French counterterrorism magistrates, the inquiry was spurred by the sale of an AK-47 assault rifle to an IHH leader by, quote, a member of the illegal organization VASAT. Turkish police reported seizing a series of disturbing items from the IHH in Turkey, including an explosive device, 2 sticks of dynamite, bomb-making instructions, and a jihad flag. The French magistrates' report noted that, Quote, it appears that the detained members of IHH were going to fight in Afghanistan, Bosnia, and Chechnya. The essential goal of this association was to illegally arm its membership for overthrowing democratic, secular, and constitutional order present in Turkey and replacing it with an Islamic state founded on the Sharia. Under the cover of this organization under the name of IHH, IHH leaders acted to recruit veteran soldiers in anticipation of the coming Holy War. In particular, some men were sent into war zones in Muslim countries in order to acquire combat experience. On the spot, the formation of a military unit was assured as a result. In addition, towards the purpose of obtaining political support from these countries, financial aid was transferred from IHH, as well as caches of firearms, knives, and prefabricated explosives. An official review of the phone records from the IHH's office in Istanbul revealed two calls to the Bosnian Mujahideen Brigade Unit headquarters in Zenica, five phone calls to a member of the Algerian Armed Islamic Group based in London, and at least one to Anwar Shaban's notorious Islamic Cultural Institute in Milan, Italy. The IHH's connections to international terrorism have even surfaced in sworn testimony in the U.S. federal court system. Check this out, because this group was connected to the Millennial Bomb plot in Los Angeles. During the trial of attempted Millennium bomber Ahmed Rassam, noted French counterterrorism magistrate Jean-Louis Bruguière took the stand and testified that IHH had played, quote, an important role, unquote, in Rassam's bomb plot targeting LAX. Under repeated questioning, Bruguière insisted that, quote, there's a rather close relation, unquote. The IHH is a non-governmental organization, but it was kind of a type of cover-up in order to obtain forged documents and also to obtain different forms of infiltration for Mujahideen in combat, and also to go and gather and recruit these Mujahid. And finally, one of the last responsibilities that they had was also to be implicated or involved in weapons trafficking, unquote. By the way, if some of the verbiage here sounds a little awkward, these are translated. Continuing, of the IHH, the author writes, Evan Coleman, none of this information is considered sensitive or secret, nor is it particularly difficult to come by. Turkish government officials have openly acknowledged as much in Western media outlets. In August of 1999, the governor of Istanbul was interviewed in the Washington Post after he personally ordered IHH bank accounts frozen because of suspected criminal activity. He explained at the time, quote, all legal institutions may have some illegal connections. This might be the case here. If they don't like it, they can appeal in court, unquote. To his credit, the former Istanbul governor here underscores another critical point. Contemporary terror finance networks are most effectively curtailed using accepted legal sanctions and transnational cooperation between regional allies. Incidents such as the deadly Gaza flotilla raid ultimately undermine the battle against illicit financing and weaken shared international resolve to punish those who manipulate humanitarian relief as a cover to fund terrorism. The Israeli government must be more mindful in the future of the wider political repercussions its attempts at punitive actions can have, whether technically justified or not. Those repercussions impact not only the state of Israel, but also carry implicit costs for both the United States and its European allies. And again, there are numerous Muslim Brotherhood connections to the flotilla. Very briefly, from the Global Muslim Brotherhood Daily Report, by the way, which feeds down the front page of my website, spitfirelist.com. Dutch foundation tied to Gaza flotilla organizer was working with Turkish charity involved. It reads in part, a Dutch foundation tied to the Global Muslim Brotherhood and linked to major Gaza flotilla organizer has been working with the Turkish charity known as the IHH, the sponsor of the ship involved in the confrontation with the Israeli naval forces. According to Dutch records, the Stichting KUDUSVAKFI was founded in 2003. Kudüs Vakfı is translated from Turkish as Jerusalem Foundation, and it appears that Kudüs Vakfı is the same foundation known earlier as the Stiftung Jerusalem, or Jerusalem Foundation, and which is a likely successor organization to the Al-Aqsa Foundation Netherlands, whose assets were frozen in April of 2003 by the Ministry of the Interior, who stated that the organization was collecting money for Hamas and or organizations related to Hamas that support or develop terrorist activities. And that milieu, by the way, is connected to people associated with the milieu of the bank Al-Taqwa. Now, one of the things that I find so interesting about this, and, well, there are a lot of things interesting about it. And again, leaving aside the implications of this for Israel, the whole Palestinian conflict, etc., what is interesting about this is the role of the contemporary Turkish government, because since the Turkish government raided IHH back in 1997 and found, among other things, that the IHH was recruiting jihadists to overthrow Turkey's secular government, the AK party, basically what is viewed as a moderate Islamist party of Mr. Erdogan, has come to power. And as we looked at in For the Record 408, and some of this documentation will be in present in the description for 723, Mr. Erdogan's party and his predecessor, Mr. Erbakan, Nekmetin Erbakan, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, are closely associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and the Bank Al-Taqwa and Ahmed Huber himself, a protege of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who held the rank of general in the Waffen-SS. Huber also a protege of Johann von Leers, later Omar Amin Lahars, or Omar Amin von Leers. He was in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry, then jumped to Nasser's government, converted to Islam, and became a mentor to Ahmed Huber of the Bank Al-Taqwa. The current government of Turkey is an Islamist government, viewed as mild, but one has to wonder. Again, in 408, the links between the current Turkish government and the milieu of the Bank Al-Taqwa are set forth. Now, one of the things that's interesting about the behavior of the current Turkish government is the extent to which it is, at least vis-a-vis the flotilla incident and Gaza, it appears to be recapitulating to an extent the role of the old Ottoman Empire with regard to the Arabs. The Muslim Arab population, in fact, more than that, the entire Arab population was part of the old Ottoman Empire, which collapsed at the end of World War I. And one of the things that's interesting is to see Turkey, which had, after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and under the influence of Kemal Atatürk, had turned away from Islamism and had maintained a rigorous secular outlook. What appears to be taking place now is that Turkey is basically recapitulating its role under its old Ottoman Empire role of serving as something of a protector state, or at least ostensibly a protector state for the Arabs. And indeed, after Turkey was rejected for EU membership, or for membership in the, well, basically EU membership, one has to wonder whether that is causing its turn back to the past. So at least with regard to the flotilla incident, we are seeing Turkey behaving in a manner reminiscent of its Ottoman past. Now, two things very quickly. First of all, the contemporary Turkish government, again, a quote moderate unquote Islamist government with links going to Bank Al-Taqwa and the Muslim Brotherhood, the current Turkish government is anything but unattached to the IHH. Note also that the IHH was recently banned by the German government. That's the charity that was behind the flotilla incident. From the New York Times of July 15th of 2010, sponsor of flotilla tied to elite of Turkey. This from Tyler Hicks of the New York Times. It reads in part, "The Turkish charity that led the flotilla involved in a deadly Israeli raid has extensive connections with Turkey's political elite, and the group's efforts to challenge Israel's blockade of Gaza received support at the top levels of the governing party," Turkish diplomats and government officials said yesterday. An anti-Israeli slogan in Istanbul reflects the rift in Israeli-Turkish relations after the raid. Turkey warns that relations could be irreparably damaged. The charity, the Humanitarian Relief Foundation, often called IHH, has come under attack in Israel and the West for offering financial support to groups accused of terrorism. But in Turkey, the group has helped Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan shore up support from conservative Muslims ahead of critical elections next year and improve Turkey's standing and influence in the Arab world. And by the way, going to have to move quickly here due to the limitations of time. As seen in a BBC article, among others, the political fortunes of Erdogan's party were flagging, basically, until the flotilla incident. It was not doing well in the polls, and it's facing an election. However, after playing the Israeli card in the flotilla incident, Erdogan's party soared in popularity. And again, this New York Times article, which will be excerpted at considerable length in the description for the program, discusses the profound links between the contemporary Turkish government and the flotilla. Skipping down, on Monday, Germany banned the IHH charity's offices, citing its support for Hamas, which Germany considers a terrorist organization. So Germany has actually banned that organization. So one of the things to think about as we look at a Turkey that appears, at least in certain respects, to be recapitulating its political past, that is, to what extent are we going to see pan-Turkism dovetail with Islamism in the Earth Island? Are we going to see an increased attempt at luring some of the peoples of Central Asia and the Earth Island into a renewed pan-Turkist entity, pan-Turkism hooking up with Islamism? Now, historically, the pan-Turkism of Kemal Ataturk has rejected Islamism and has been secular in nature. Last item, shortly before the flotilla incident and before Mr. Erdogan's party began flagging in the polls, there was a roundup of many high-ranking active duty and former Turkish army officers who were charged with staging a coup. A thought that I'm going to leave you is, to what extent was that done to sort of, was that something of a preemptive strike by Erdogan's government? Because traditionally the Turkish army has been secular in orientation and has resisted Islamism. Are the growing pan-Turkish sentiments in the Earth Island and Turkey's recapitulating its Ottoman foreign policy and the arresting of the Turkish officers, are those linked? And are we going to see pan-Turkism and Islamism hooking up in the Earth Island? I don't know, but I hope that in this admittedly complex broadcast, I've been able to set forth some of the questions and enable you to look at some of the dynamics that are unfolding in the Earth Island. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 723, Doing the Earth Island Boogie. This has been recorded on August 29th of the year 2010. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.